going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thank you so much, Capital. It is the Going Deep podcast. And often in this space with this podcast, the conversations that I have, the things that I'm curious about, are inspired by what's going on in the world, albeit sports or otherwise. And naturally, many of you know that the musical artist Diddy is essentially on the run, has multiple houses raided because of what has been alleged against him in relation to sexual assault and sexual harassment. And it had me thinking that we are years removed from the Me Too movement, and yet we still are often having the same conversations about bad actors, oftentimes men, more often than not men with power. And that is something that we see quite often in the field of sport. So I was a bit curious as to, well, how are we doing in sport? What are the experiences? And have there been, if at all, any changes in sports post Me Too movement? The best person to ask is, for me, a faculty member at Temple University, and that would be Dr. Elizabeth Taylor, who has studied and worked in the field of understanding women's experiences with sexual harassment, specifically in sports organizations. She interviewed women in the sports industry, whether they're working for professional leagues or teams or sports media or even entrepreneurs, trying to find out why women frequently find themselves the victims of sexual harassment at disproportionate levels within sport. Every single person she spoke to, every single participant, had experienced sexual harassment on some level. And so I want to know why we think that's happening in sport. Are there any guardrails being put in place so that it doesn't happen? And should we be optimistic or pessimistic that it'll happen less moving forward? Let's go deep with Dr. Elizabeth Taylor on the Me Too movement in sport. So, Doctor, I've talked about on this podcast how, in my estimation, you have movements and you have a lot of attention and momentum, and then the energy fizzles over time. I believe that has been the case post George Floyd with the racial reckoning we had post Me Too movement. How have you seen the changes in attitudes, behaviors, language been sustained?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think that you're right on. I think what we have seen more of in kind of this post Me Too era is more women coming forward to share their stories. So there's a stretch over the last couple of years when I felt like every time I logged on to social media, I saw a post about a woman who was working in sport or a woman athlete who was sharing a story of abuse or an article from news outlets like The Gist or something similar, sharing a report of an instance of gender-based violence. I think that has slowed some, but I still believe sport is an outlier in terms of industries and still has a large number of instances of harassment, gender-based violence, sex discrimination, that sort of thing, as compared to other industries.
I assume that was the catalyst for you wanting to start this research?
Yeah, so my research on harassment actually started on women faculty members and their experiences of sexual harassment, because when I was a PhD student at the University of Tennessee, I was sexually harassed by a student in the classroom. So that kind of sparked my interest, if you will, in the topic of sexual harassment related to research. But yeah, a colleague and I were sitting in the office one day and just, you know, maybe eating lunch or something like that, kind of socializing. And she pulled up her phone and was like, look at this, another story of a woman working in sport who is who's sharing a story of sexual harassment in the workplace. And it was at a time when the more like general management and business literature is suggesting that instances of overt harassment and discrimination are decreasing, with instances of microaggressions on the rise. But that wasn't what we were seeing in the sport industry. We were seeing this more overt sexual harassment, instances of sexual assault, rape, physical abuse, that sort of thing. And so we spent about a week going back and forth, just sharing these instances as we saw them, and we decided that we needed to investigate. We decided that there was more to the story in sport, and while instances of microaggressions surely are on the rise, especially gender-based microaggressions and racial microaggressions are absolutely on the rise, we just didn't think the same thing was happening with the decreases in the overt harassment like we were seeing or what was being reported in other industries.
Well, first off, I hate that the catalyst for the work had to be you experiencing, you know, unfortunate situations. So often our education is inspired by our trauma, and the people who have felt the pain have to do the work. So both sorry and thank you at the same time. Is that's unfortunate. As you go through and do this work, were there key findings or takeaways that surprised you?
Yeah, I think so. We interviewed 21 women, and all 21 women who we spoke with had experienced some form of gender-based violence. And this ranged from microaggressions to more overt sexism. We had women disclose to us that they were raped by colleagues. We had women disclose to us that they were physically abused. In this instance, the woman who was describing her physical abuse, it was in the workplace, in a work meeting. She was physically abused by a colleague. And I think I was surprised, not that they had all experienced this, because that's kind of, you know, based on what we were seeing on posts on social media, we assumed that women would have these experiences, but I didn't assume how intense they were, how, you know, you assume the microaggressions, the maybe crude jokes, that sort of thing, but I had never had a participant disclose that they were raped before by a colleague, that, you know, the physical abuse that was described in this instance by the participant, it was traumatic for me to hear it as a researcher. And so I can't even imagine the trauma that they experienced having to go through that and then return to the workplace the next day and go back to just life as usual, like nothing had happened. And so I think that was quite shocking. And I think one thing that I didn't understand, I, as a researcher and as an educator, when we talk about HR, I think we talk about HR as like this support for employees, like this subsector of the organization that's supposed to be there to ensure that policies and procedures are being utilized appropriately, that adequate policies and procedures are in place to support employees. And one thing that really shocked me was the way in which all of these women understood that HR was not there to support them, but HR was there to protect the organization. And so these organizations didn't provide adequate support via HR channels. So they either didn't have proper reporting channels in some instances of women who had experienced abuse. In other cases, the person the women were supposed to report to was their harasser or their abuser. And so in this way, there wasn't an avenue for them to report in a way that they felt safe and supported to do so. And so one of the key findings that we came away with is that the organization and HR were really working to silence these women through what we call containment strategies. And this is a term and a concept that comes out of military research. But essentially what the goal is here for the organization is that they ensure these instances of harassment and gender-based violence don't get leaked outside of the organization. So they don't put proper reporting channels in place so that it can't be reported. And the women kind of come to understand that either they put up with this or they go and find a new job somewhere else. They really came to, you know, accept this behavior as what they had to put up with if they wanted to work in the sport industry. And then when the organization does this, they can continue to operate as status quo. So they can continue to operate as a successful organization, as an organization that maybe they post for Women's History Month about how much they love their women employees, or, you know, maybe they do something like that to illustrate that they care, but at the end of the day, they're not actually caring for their employees because they're silencing them through these containment strategies.
I want to touch on that HR point because employees feeling, whether real or otherwise, that they have an adversarial relationship with HR because they are literally in business to protect the company is not unique to sport, but at some point, can't both things be true where you can protect the company by supporting the women, thus not leaving yourself open for litigation, or forget about HR, just the bad PR that would come with it being known that you silenced an employee?
Yeah, you think, right? Like, that's what kind of makes sense in my mind is that you're able to both support your employees, but also support the organization. It seems intuitive to me that they would be one in the same, right? But I think what so many women, and we talked to women who had been in their career for 6 months, and we talked to women who had been in the industry for over 20 years. We talked to women who had left jobs because of the harassment and the gender-based violence that they faced. We talked to women who left the sport industry in general because of the harassment that they had faced. And I think a couple things work to kind of suggest that, and maybe you've heard this, like, and I think we have this conversation in the classroom sometimes about how like coveted positions in sport are. And so these women really felt like they couldn't risk it. They couldn't risk making a scene, even if that meant that it might leak and that they could get the support that they needed outside of the organization. And maybe, like you're kind of saying, through litigation or something like that. But what they felt like was if they did that, they would ruin their career and their chances to continue to work in the sport industry. And so kind of that idea of like this scarcity of positions. And I always say, like, working in sport is sexy. Everybody wants to work in sport because it seems really glamorous. And so you have these instances where hundreds of people are applying to entry-level jobs. And so the women felt as though they were replaceable. And so they didn't want to, one, they didn't have the channels to report, or the person who they were supposed to report to was their harasser, but they also felt like maybe they wouldn't do it even if they could, because they didn't want to jeopardize their career. Because a lot of them talked about how hard it was for them to get into the industry, that they had to work for a number of years to get the same opportunities that their men colleagues had. And they had to endure this behavior because they wanted to continue to work in an industry that they loved. And so I think yes. And that's kind of what we talk about in our article, in terms of some of the like managerial implications, is looking at how organizations can support all of their employees and build a culture that is truly inclusive of women. And we talk about how that's much larger than just this idea of like one bad apple. I think that's what so many times when we hear these stories, it's like, oh, well, they fired so-and-so and he was the real root of the issue. He was the abuser. But the way that organizational culture kind of comes to accept these behaviors then makes it more widespread than just one single bad apple or bad actor in the organization. It's kind of more immersed in the culture.
You mentioned earlier the prevalence of these issues in sports relative to other industries, other businesses. Certainly, there's a power dynamic aspect to this wherever it happens. You mentioned the scarcity of roles and ability, but are there other specific unique challenges in sports, in terms of eradicating these issues, that maybe other sectors don't face?
Yeah, I think so. So I think about it as like everything about sport from the inception of sport has really been organized by men for men, right? And so women have kind of been, women kind of play this role, or they're often seen as outsiders or invaders, because they have traditionally been unwelcomed in these spaces as athletes, as employees, as fans. And so these organizations and the male-dominated nature of these spaces creates instances where men really create a culture that devalues women. And as a result, the culture kind of comes to be accepting of this discrimination, harassment, and gender-based violence. And so we see that with the way that women athletes are treated differently than men athletes, the way that women fans, there's a lot of research on the experiences of women fans and how their fandom is devalued, how they're constantly questioned, oh, if you're a real fan, name the starting, you know, whatever players in the 29 Super Bowl or whatever. And so the way in which we really question women in this space, it spans all the different stakeholders who are women. And so a lot of the experiences that of women who we talked to, they talked about that, how there was something about sport that they just really loved, despite some of the challenges that they had growing up as athletes, now that they're having as employees. But I think the male-dominated nature of sport and kind of the way that it's been organized by men for men really creates this culture that devalues women and their experiences across the board.
Having said that, we are seeing a rise in women's sport globally and certainly in North America. Are women's sports safer for women?
I can't say for certain, but we did talk to several women who left either working for a men's professional team or a men's professional league and started working in women's sports and found their experience to be better. Some things we do know just about like the gender and racial breakdown of employees, based on research out of the Tide Center, which is a research center at the University of Central Florida. The WNBA is the only league of all the leagues examined, so it includes all the men's professional leagues, college sport, and sport media. The WNBA is the only league where women hold at least an equal percentage of leadership positions. We see a lot more racial diversity in the WNBA as well. And so when we talked to these participants who had left men's sports to work in women's sports. They talked about how on their interview, they saw more women in the organization. There were more women who were present in terms of like being on the hiring committee, being in leadership and decision-making positions. They really felt like the organization was more purposeful in how they appreciated and celebrated their women employees. And so perhaps there is something to that, is the fact that these leagues that are popping up, like you said, across the world, that are offering more opportunities for women athletes, maybe they are more inclusive of women as employees, of women as fans, and kind of creating this safer place for women in sport.
So you do all this research, have all this data, and then what? And now what do we do with it? I'm reticent to say, what's your recommendation for women working in sports? Because how about you just don't harass or abuse me? How's that sound? How's that for a recommendation? But in terms of the data, twofold, what is recommendation for leagues and sports organizations? But also at the same time, what do you think it's important for women to be cognizant of based off of what you now are aware of based off the research?
Yeah, I think both are really important. Obviously, I wish that we could just say don't harass. Obviously, I wish that organizations would take every instance of gender-based violence seriously. But a couple of things that we talked to women about was the need for employees, all employees, prospective employees, to do their research about organizations. So we talked to a number of women who indicated they saw red flags. So things like no women in their interview process whatsoever, sexist remarks made to them on their interview, high turnover of women in organizations, and they didn't think anything of it, or they still took the job anyway. So it's really critical that we ask questions through this process of figuring out where do we want to work and where can we work and be successful and be safe. So doing things like reaching out to current and former employees and gathering as much information as you can on a position and an organization before accepting that position is something that a lot of these women talked about. It was interesting listening to them kind of walk through. We asked them a question just about their process of identifying positions that they were going to apply to, and then like walking through the interview stage of different positions before they accepted a position. And a lot of them, as they were talking, they were like, wow, I never thought about this while I was on the interview. Like they're like, these are a lot of red flags that like I just never even thought might mean that it would be problematic for me to work in this area. And a lot of them talked about how they love talking with, you know, whether it's like women sport management students, women business students, women who are on the job market. They love talking with kind of the next generation of employees. So if you are on the job hunt and you go on LinkedIn and you see someone works for an organization where you're applying, they were like, please reach out to us. Like, we want to help you through this process. We want to tell you about our experiences because we never want someone to have to deal with the harassment that we dealt with. And so I thought that was really encouraging that they were so open to talking with people. A lot of them expressed similar to what you said at the beginning, I'm so sorry and thank you. A lot of them expressed this like gratefulness that we were asking these questions. They were like, nobody's ever asked me about my experience before. So I'm just really grateful to be able to share these stories with you. It felt like in a way it was like maybe a little bit therapeutic for them to share these instances. So they were really passionate about talking with the next generation of sport managers and ensuring that they leave the culture of the organization better than they had it or tried to do that. Another thing that they talked about was to really find a support network. And so many of the women talked about how they, as they were experiencing this harassment, maybe it was because one woman in particular talked about how there were no women who she worked with. And so she didn't feel like she could share these experiences with anyone. She didn't feel like she really had anyone to turn to. And so she finally reached out to a supervisor from a previous position who was working for a sport organization in the same city. She said they got together and she shared her experiences with her previous supervisor, her mentor. And the woman was like, we need to get you out of this position. This is not okay what you're going through. And so it took hearing that from someone else for this participant to really understand what she was going through was abuse and that it wasn't okay that she was having to put up with it. So just really finding a network of folks who you can turn to and share your experiences and say things like, this doesn't feel right, but can I talk this through with you? Like, do you have any recommendations for me? Like, you know, here's our reporting channels. This is why I feel like I can't share my experiences with HR or the person who I'm supposed to report to is the person who's harassing me. So just kind of this network of, in the instance of our participants, they talked a lot about how for them, it was other women in the industry. And not necessarily at their organization, but just this support network of women to confide in and share their experiences was something they felt was really, really necessary for their success and their well-being in the industry. So those were two things that they were really, really kind of clear on. Do your research before you accept a position and then kind of, I guess, if you will, find your girl gang who you can really lean on and turn to for advice and support.
I think your point about the red flags in the interview process is an important one. To be honest, for men to hear, just in terms of privilege, right? Certainly there's a privilege in not thinking about being harassed or how you have to move in your career and how things may or may not be perceived or ascertaining was that harassment or was that, you know, something else. But certainly in the hunt to find work, it's another thing you don't necessarily, in most cases, have to think about. And that changes your options, changes the amount of leverage you may have in a given situation. So good to learn and understand that things were far from equal in many different ways. You talked about the experience for many of the subjects you interviewed. I have to ask, if I may, what was the experience for you like going through this work, which I could imagine would range anywhere from being traumatic to therapeutic given your own experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did camera optional Zoom interviews, and there were times when I was so grateful that the participant had opted not to have their camera on because I was crying listening to their stories. I had numerous times where I was supposed to have a meeting following an interview and either the interview went long and I had to, you know, quick text someone and cancel a meeting, or I just couldn't. I couldn't stop thinking about their experiences and how alone they clearly felt and how awful I felt that they had to deal with that. I often, you know, there are times when I feel like my job is so challenging. I have a student who's really challenging, or, you know, a lecture doesn't go the way that I thought it would. And I say, like, I'm just going to quit and I'm going to go and I'm going to get a job in the sport industry and I probably could make more money and whatever. And then I'm like, no, absolutely not. Like, after hearing these stories, it really, I think, made me feel like, wow, I can't imagine going to work every day and feeling the way that some of these women felt and feeling like I didn't have anyone to turn to. So when I was getting my PhD at the University of Tennessee, I went to my advisor and I kind of explained everything that had been happening. And my advisor was a straight white man, and I'll never forget when he apologized and was like, I can't imagine what this is like for you. And he said, I can't even begin to understand in my position of privilege, but let's get you the support that you need. And so he reached out to different women across the country and connected me with them. And it really allowed me to build my network of support that I still turn to today. And so hearing how passionate these women are about creating change, and that's why a lot of them said that they shared their story, is they want change. They want the sport industry to be a space that is accepting of all humans. And so hearing that there are other folks like me who just really want sport to be an accepting place. I was a two-sport athlete in college. I had the time of my life. It's why I'm here. I had just the greatest teammates and coaches and mentors. And my husband is a college coach. My dad was a college coach. I have two kids that are starting to play sport. And so I have just like the most fond memories of it. And I want it to be that space for everyone. And so I think that's really, really what drives this work and drives this want to create a positive culture. And so I really felt encouraged that these women were willing to be vulnerable, to share some of the most traumatic experiences of their life in the name of change. And so I think for me, that was really one of the take-home pieces. As I was doing the interviews, it was really very emotional. When my colleague and I were coding the interviews, we sat on Zoom for hours reading these interviews, just crying, thinking about these instances. And so I think that was really challenging to do kind of over and over again. But again, I was so encouraged by the way that these women talked about how they navigated these situations and why they were sharing their stories and really what sport meant to them and working in sport meant to them. And so I feel encouraged. I think we have a long way to go, but I really felt encouraged talking to them and thinking about the future and thinking about being able to share these stories in spaces like this, where we can reach an audience in a way that a 40-page research paper is not going to, it's not going to do that to the, you know, the average sport fan or the average sport employee. They're not going to want to sit and read that. Heck, I don't even want to sit and read that most days, and that's my job. So, you know, having these opportunities to share this research, I think, is really meaningful. And I'm hopeful that it's impactful for folks who are in the industry, athletes, fans, all of the stakeholders.
I'm sure it will be. And I think you may have answered it in your last question, but just to be sure, I'm going to make you be a prof and give a grade and give us a bit of a progress report. Are you optimistic, pessimistic, neutral on these things and the way we're trending in sports moving forward?
Yeah, I am optimistic because I think this next generation of employees, I see it in a lot of our students. They are much more thoughtful in their behaviors and the way that they support each other and the things that they want, both for themselves and for their colleagues and for their organization. And so I think I am really hopeful about the future because I think this next generation of employees is really, they're not going to put up with it in the way that maybe past generations have. So I see a lot of our male students speaking up about women's sports. They're passionate about women's sports. They're passionate about topics related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, social justice. And that really does make me hopeful. Obviously, there is a lot of phasing out of problematic older generations and kind of that old school mentality about what sport is and what it should look like. But I am optimistic about the future as I see our students sitting in class and asking really thoughtful questions and worrying about their work-life balance and things that, you know, even I mean, I don't know. I feel old a lot of days. I don't know if I am really that old yet, but even people who are, you know, in their mid 30s, like I am, we never felt empowered to say, no, I'm not going to do that. Or no, I'm not going to put up with that behavior or that treatment. So that does make me optimistic about the future.
And for our audience who does want more and maybe is willing to sit through a 40-page research paper, where can they find more information to educate themselves about the topic and share your findings with others?
Yeah, absolutely. So this research was recently accepted for publication in the Journal of Sport Management, which is an academic journal that serves sport management institutions around the world. So I'm happy to share the link with you, and you can share it with folks. I'm happy to share the article as well. It's behind a paywall that if you work in certain sectors, you might have access to, or students probably have access to it through their institution. But I'm happy to share it with anyone. I'd love to get it out there for more folks to read. Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll definitely put both in the show notes of this podcast. Thank you so much, Doctor. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much to Dr. Elizabeth Taylor for bravely sharing and bravely doing that work. If you'd like to read up on some of that work, go into our show notes where you can find the hyperlink to some of the documents that Dr. Taylor was talking about. We are going to take a break from talking, but not take a break from trying to find out answers on how sports is doing on social justice and human rights issues. DEI has been, for some, a swear word, and it's been weaponized politically, and sports is included in that conversation. Why is that the case, and how can we eradicate that? Stay with us. You'll find out.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is the show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had the show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And on a previous episode of the Going Deep podcast, I talked to my boy Cabby about the fact that DEI has become a political football in the United States, and we're not far from the same being true in Canada. So much so that potentially collegiate athletes might boycott the state of Florida and its institutions because of the removal of DEI practices at state institutions and publicly funded institutions as well. When it comes to DEI in sport, the longest serving conversation that we've had is around affirmative action, specifically the Rooney Rule in the NFL. Now, there have been attacks on the Rooney Rule, even though it seems to be making progress. But is that progress because of the Rooney Rule? Or is that progress because of some exceptional candidates happen to be outliers in 2024? Well, I am tasking a distinguished DEI strategist and author to help me wade these choppy waters. And that would be Amber Cabral. Let's go deep on the legacy and viability of the Rooney Rule and the threat on all things DEI. So, Amber, we have 9 minority head coaches in the NFL, and many people are waving the victory flag saying, oh, racism is over. The Rooney Rule is finally victorious. Certainly that's shown some progress, but we generally don't adjudicate things in a 365-day sample size. There's a difference between process and outcome. Can you give your assessment on the process of the Rooney Rule and then the outcome that we've now found ourselves at?
So to put it very simply, the Rooney Rule is very, it's like 101. Like it is, let's make sure we don't say anything offensive. Let's make sure that we have at the very bare minimum checked the box that says we are not going to be discriminatory. it doesn't do enough to make sure that the experience of these people, once they are selected, is going to be equitable. It doesn't do enough to say that just because these folks are going to be considered, that they will be selected. It doesn't do enough to say once they are selected that they are going to be able to have recourse if they are having experiences that are contrary to those that they should be having to assure their safety and growth and all of those fantastic things. So it's 101, you know what I mean? Like, it's 101. And so I think anytime something is 101 and it is doing something, people are going to celebrate. It's very similar to me when everyone was like, racism is over, we've had a Black president. And I'm like, okay, but let's stand where we are now and look back at all the backlash that has come since that. And so this is going to be very similar. Like, hey, we got the win. And then there's going to be backlash, unless there's also some other intentionality around being thoughtful about the other elements that come with when you bring people into an organization that has otherwise not done well with representation.
Well, there's so many sides to this conversation. Given your work, I know that you understand this and see this, as do I. There will be a loud part of the population that says, well, this is actually discrimination. This is reverse racism. If you have this role, you are a diversity hire. How do you safeguard and put up a firewall against those sorts of accusations?
Yeah, I think, so a couple things I think are really important. I think first and foremost, like, I don't know that we can ever safeguard or have we cannot protect ourselves from accusations. That isn't the country we live in. That's not the experience that we're having here. But what we can do is be able to speak intelligently about why things are maybe not the best idea and what we can do to make them better. So I obviously don't have a mic with the NFL. If I had a mic with the NFL, my response would go a little something like, hey, I can understand why you might feel like this is a little bit of maybe tokenism, or maybe this is a little check the box, or maybe it can even potentially be positioned as discriminatory. I don't necessarily agree with that perspective, but I can see how this thing may be shaped that way. But if we took some more purposeful actions around, okay, have we thought about what the experience has been of coaches in the past, of leaders in the NFL in the past? Have we also thought about what the representation looks like in these other areas? If you want to take meaningful steps, there are ways to do that where I can meet your need, which is saying, hey, this is reverse discrimination, which there is no such thing. And we can also solve the real problem. But that's not the conversation anybody wants to have, right? Because when we're talking about solutions, number one, solutions cost money. Secondly, you're talking about an organization that historically just hasn't done really well when the mirror is held up to say, hey, I am seeing some practices and some behaviors here that can cause some blatant offense, discrimination, oppression for a specific class of folks. They have not been willing or responsible to lean in and take ownership of that and say, hey, let's purposefully make some adjustments that are going to make meaningful change. So, like, the reason it's a difficult conversation is because the argument is a facade, and it is almost as much of a facade as the Rooney Rule is. Like, it is what we have. I think that keeping it in place is better than not having it, but is it the best approach? No, but you don't want the best approach. So you want to try to argue about why we shouldn't take any approach at all, when the real argument needs to be, hey, this isn't the best approach. Great, let's find the best one. And that's not happening.
You mentioned finding solutions cost money. And sometimes when you can't move people based off of morals, you can move them based off of money. What is the argument, whether it's professional sports leagues or Fortune 500 companies or non-for-profits for that matter, to make sure that they are hiring from a diverse pool and ultimately having a diverse staff? What is the business case around it?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, there's a lot of business case, but anytime someone says business case for me, I wonder what planet they live on, because we all see what our workplaces look like. We also see how they look on television. We also see how they look in other parts of the world. So, like, that we have the business case with our eyeballs if we just will look around. But you know, the thing that I always want to encourage people to consider is like, what is representation in your community or in the community that this organization rests in looks like? And what does the consumer community look like? For most organizations, that's going to give you a good picture of like where you are. And I don't think that that's any different for whether we're talking about, you know, sports, which we know the consumers of sports are a vast myriad of identities, you know, or if we're talking about, you know, Fortune ranked organizations or philanthropic ones or whatever, right? So I think that like the thing that we like to skip over is, what do we look like? What do the people we serve look like? And if we can get really clear about, and look, not just being race. I think the other thing about the Rooney Rule is it is very centered on racial identity or even ethnicity to a degree. So that is only one layer. You know, when we're talking about talent, talent also includes people who are from different experiential backgrounds, people who, you know, have different physical ability. You know, so there's a lot of layers to that. When we're talking about creating an equitable experience that says, we need to look across what are we made up of? Are we doing a good job of being representative of those ideas internally? Because, I mean, pointedly, the data says when we have folks that look like who we are serving, we serve better. We make a broader impact. We make more money. So there is a financial incentive to do this in addition to the moral one. In addition to that, I don't think people consider like the implications of like if you have an entire series of categories of people who do not have access to robust opportunity, what their alternative behaviors will become. So if you're the same person complaining about an uptick in crime, you can also take a look at what's happening with employment. You know, so like, I think we also have to be considerate that like, it's all connected. And when you choose to opt out of a portion of it because you're uncomfortable with the diversity among us or, you know, connecting with people across difference, you are not eliminating the problem. You are exacerbating. In addition to that, we're also moving into a period where, you know, specifically for, you know, companies, you know, outside of the NFL that aren't necessarily in the sports world, where, you know, you have the biggest wealth transfer in history happening. You also are looking at generations that are more diverse in terms of race and ethnicity, in terms of ability, in terms of gender. So like we are moving towards more diverse identity, and these folks have money. So they don't necessarily have to go to work. So now you're looking at how am I going to attract talent when the pool is smaller and the pool is more diverse? So it behooves us to be thoughtful about the whole picture. What am I doing that is going to attract the kind of talent that is going to help my organization survive and thrive into the future as what talent looks like in the future is evolving, as what talent folks are willing to allow or tolerate for in the workplace because they don't need money the same way because we are in the midst of that wealth transfer, right? Like what they are willing to deal with in the workplace. I tell a lot of my clients, like, you can decide to do it now where you get a say on what your workplace culture and experience is, and you can message that and you can shape that story and you can attract the kind of talent you want. And you can be on the front side of learning how to make sure you're creating spaces that are equitable for that talent. Or you're going to be forced to do it if you want to survive, because that's going to be the talent that's available.
You mentioned earlier there's no such thing as reverse racism. As you know, there are many people who vehemently disagree with you. And this is not unique to sport. This is an issue we're seeing across the board, and it's an issue that's now becoming litigious. The Supreme Court upended race-conscious college admissions in June. That essentially has opened up Pandora's box in terms of challenging corporate diversity, equity, inclusion measures at all levels in all companies. And the first thing these companies are often worried about is what can we be sued about, not what will actually be held up in a court of law. What do you see being the impact of this really becoming a political football that has found its way in the courts?
So here's, I'm going to try to say the quiet part out loud responsibly. The thing about all of the things that people think of when they hear DEI, or specifically when we talk about affirmative action, all of it, people like to just bucket it down to race. We like to say it's just race. And specifically in the case of the overturning of, you know, the college admissions processes, like that was specific to race. And the problem is equity, diversity, inclusion, those things are bigger than just race. And so for a lot of organizations, before 2020, we didn't talk openly about race. We made it a very contentious, uncomfortable, difficult conversation in workplaces and even in the NFL. We all remember the whole Colin Kaepernick series of events, right? So we can still do the work without saying race. It can still happen. We can still make impactful decisions because a lot of what creates equity is about behavior. It's about responsible communication. It's about being able to be thoughtful about the experience of the people that you work with and support. It's about knowing how to apologize when you misstep. It's about taking ownership and feedback. It's about being able to give and receive feedback. So these are leadership skills. These are things that help people to human together in general. So I think while I am very, as a Black woman from the city of Detroit, deeply disappointed about the idea that like we are moving to a place where folks want to not talk about race again, it does not put me in the position where I feel like we cannot still do the work. I do think we have to be thoughtful about how we can approach things. I think we have enough data that also says that there are many things that correlate to race that people will still want to hang on to the benefit of, namely money. So there are lots of opportunities for us to push position things that serve communities that are in, you know, specific poverty levels that will still reach the populations that are of diverse identity that need that kind of support. We are not at the place where we're saying we do not want to help people who are wheelchair users. We do not want to help people who are, you know, neurodivergent. So like we still have a lot of opportunity to show up and make an impact in the workplaces, in the sports organizations that do, much to my disappointment, you know, still have the ability to happen without us having to frame it around race. Now, do I think that that's ideal? No. Do I love the framing? Not necessarily, because in reality, particularly here in the United States, race is a critical part of your day-to-day experience. If you are a member of a underrepresented identity, that plays a part in how you experience everything from home ownership to shopping at your local grocery store. It is a factor. But we are also fortunate enough that we live in the day and age where we have so much data and we have so much information that I can frame it in a way that you'll appreciate if you are a person that doesn't know how to navigate the racial discussion, so that I can still be impactful with the programming, so that I can still be impactful with the hiring processes. And if we're thinking about true equity, a lot of the reasons why, you know, many people that I'm colleagues with mention, you know, racial identity is because we have, you know, evidence that when you lift from the bottom, everybody goes up, you know? And so the ideal is if we can solve for the folks that we know that are often at the bottom, which typically are our Black and brown communities and, you know, other communities of color, we're going to make an impact on the whole. But that can still happen without us having to name it. And I also think we're moving into a time period where our younger generations, you know, Generation Alpha, Gen Z, are just a lot more vocal about what they're seeing in terms of experience and what they're willing to tolerate. And so it's just going to be a very interesting atmosphere as the not young regime of folks that are in, say, NFL positions of authority, that are also in a lot of our corporate positions of authority, are having to reckon with what your new talent, you know, are requiring of you. And that's, you know, we've moved culture forward that way for generations. And so we're on the precipice of, you know, just the makeup of, you know, from a numeric standpoint of people in the workplace, we're going to see some pushes and people are going to have to move, or they're going to have to decide they don't want to do business anymore.
So I want to make sure I fully understand what you're saying, because I'm a firm believer that what doesn't get measured doesn't get done. Are you suggesting that maybe working on culture, making these things happen a little bit more organically and less structurally, less systematically, less mandated, you might be able to have similar outcomes but alleviate some of the pushback?
I don't necessarily know that I'm saying that. I think you can still have programming. I think you can still have structure. I think you can still have intention. But I think you can still do all of that without having to center it across the thing that people are the most annoyed about, which is really race. Because a lot of the work that is happening, we can still have mentorship and leadership development programs that support our talent that needs support without having to say we're doing this for Black talent specifically. We can have other measurements that will still create spaces for those folks to get into the room. So I don't in any way think that you have to diminish the action. I don't even think you have to necessarily soften what your approach is. I think you have to be careful about your language. I think you have to be careful about the way you're framing what you're tracking. And candidly, you can say we're focused on a population that is in this category, not say race, and still on the backside make note that, hey, we realize that, you know, we have predominantly people of color that come through this program. And so I do think it's going to take a little bit of us working with our legal professionals to understand like what we can and cannot say. But I don't think that the answer is ever to not track. We should always be tracking and counting and, you know, not in the let's count beans way that I think sometimes we feel like it's happening. But like, absolutely track your outcomes, absolutely track them based on race and other elements of identity. But I think we can be thoughtful and strategic about what combination of identity elements will still get us to the solve that we're looking for to create an equitable experience without having to make race the central point. And again, I don't love that. I think that we're clear that race is a central point. I think ethnicity plays a part in, again, all of our experiences. But if we are going to navigate a landscape, if we're going to continue to live in this country with organizations that also have to navigate a landscape where having a conversation about racial identity is going to create a lack of access or contention or legal issues, I think there are other ways. And so I am of the opinion that we can still roll out things that teach people how to behave and operate equitably. I think we can still give people the tools to know how to engage with people across difference responsibly. I think we can still have conversations about psychological safety in the workplace with the knowledge that perhaps that psychological safety failure happens a lot with people of color. But that's something that many people can benefit from, right? And so I think we can still resource appropriately, educate appropriately, track, but we have to be thoughtful about how we frame it. And so I think it's just a matter of making it more difficult, but I don't think it has to shut it down. Not for the people who really want to get the work done.
I remember post George Floyd's murder, and I was a bit jaded in the fact that people wanted to have the conversation now when Ahmaud Arbery had just died. Trayvon Martin had died previously. What had changed? Yeah, we sadly know the list. That hasn't stopped, quite frankly. But I remember at the moment, you know, the difference was we said Black Lives Matter, and frankly, when you write Black, make sure it's a capital B. We were, you know, intentional about the fact that BIPOC starts with Black and Indigenous. And now, you know, we move to a place where the words woke and DEI are used as weapons, right? They're just language. I wonder, given that you have been entrenched in the work, you know, through the ebbs and flows of when it's trending, are you optimistic or pessimistic on where this conversation is going moving forward?
I'm always optimistic, mostly because I know how to navigate the landscape. There are times I'm tired. There are times I feel really overwhelmed with some of what I would consider to be like extraordinarily ridiculous exercises to make this problematic in ways that it doesn't need to be. I am also sometimes really, really frustrated with the acrobatics that people will go to try to position themselves, you know, in a way to benefit from all of the, you know, like there's just a lot of elements of it that can be take a lot of energy. But I'm optimistic because a couple things that are happening right now that I see probably very differently than people who are not in my field of work. There was a time where I would go into an organization to train and they would very pointedly say to me, "Can you not say racism?" There was a time I would go into an organization and they would very pointedly ask me to not have conversations about the variance across gender identity, about LGBTQ identity. It was supposed to be intentionally vague. I don't get that anymore. People want to talk about the stuff. So the idea that people are in the position now where they're saying, hey, how can we talk about this and still be impactful? What is the responsible way to do it? Is a big step forward to me. And I understand why people really feel like it's been a big step backwards, you know, in the last probably 2 years-ish, you know, since we've had a lot of just the wokeism language and, you know, anti-DEI and don't say gay and all those things that have come out. I'm clear about why that can feel like, oh my gosh, they're taking it apart and they're dismantling it. But like, just think back before George Floyd, like we couldn't emphasize that the B in Black should be capitalized. We could not, we were not hearing racial conversations in the news. The Rooney Rule was not openly discussed. Like we are actually having the chats. We are having the debates. We are having the arguments. And to me, this is the messy middle before we get to a place where we actually are actually taking some meaningful action that will stick. So I don't like it. I think it's troubling, but I would rather be in the midst of trouble where we can actually push forward on some dialogue than be in a place that we were in before where it was like, shh, don't say that. We can't really do that anymore. So there's a lot more, I think, going on than we recognize because we're in it from moment to moment. Versus being able to stop and look back and go, oh, wow, I remember having to scrub language I had to pull examples out of certain content. I remember having to send my content to teams ahead of time so that they could proof it and take out what they didn't think I should say. And that doesn't happen the same way anymore. People are engaging in the discussions. People are talking about it with their families, even when your workplace won't do it. You're at home talking about the fact that it's not happening. So I think we are still having traction, but it's really uncomfortable right now. So the fact that we're still moving gives me some optimism.
So let's progress the conversation forward. You know, perfect is the enemy of the good. The Rooney Rule certainly is not perfect, but it has been massaged over the years. Roger Goodell hits you up as soon as you get off this call and says, blank canvas, lead me. What do you say?
Oh, wow. Probably the very first thing that I would like to do is get a good understanding of who has the D, who is the person with the decision-making power for real. Because we have the people who are framed as having the D, but then we have the people who really have it. Let's get all the people who really have the decision-making power together. And candidly, I'd like to do a little bit of assessing so that I can understand the mindsets of the folks that we're navigating so I know how to approach. I will probably want to start there. The second thing I would probably want to do is do a bit of a...
Well, hold on. We know who that is, though, don't we? It's the owners, right?
It's the owners.
It's a boys' club that can let you in if they want to, kick you out if they want to, and hire and could fire Roger Goodell.
Absolutely. So if we're not going to have a discussion where the people who have the D, okay, are willing to engage, then we're not going to be able to make meaningful progress. Like, it's just unfortunately the case. I think candidly, that's why the NFL is where it is. That's why when you see things happen with certain teams, it is literally because that team has been willing to lean in. I don't think the organization as a whole is ready. And I think if we can't get to the place where we can be honest about openly, this is who has the D, this is where they are, these are the mindsets that they're carrying. Let's at the very minimum get these folks together and have some meaningful dialogue about what a willing impactful path forward might look like. And that doesn't have to be, hey, we take out all the, you know, the white folks that are leading team. Like, that's, nobody's asking for that, right? But if we can at least have a dialogue and get a good temperature take on mindsets there, where folks truly are, because I think a lot of it is we think we know, but we haven't necessarily, in some cases we know very blatantly because they're very loud people, but in some cases we don't. I would love for us to have the ability to like really get some folks together and say, okay, this is the baseline. Let's see what two steps forward looks like. Because if you can't get that leadership to do anything, they're going to tear everything down that comes in front of them. And that's why the NFL is where it is. That's why the conversations about the wellness of the players are where they are. That's why the dialogue about, you know, just general decisions around safety is where it is. Like, I don't think you can progress forward if you do not have at least a leadership that is willing to hear, even if they're not yet willing to act.
But I hear some of my audience thinking and saying, well, what you're describing is franchise ownership. and someone buys a franchise of a certain brand and they have it in their market and they can make decisions that make sense for them in their market. Is this conversation any different than if I, you know, bought a Trader Joe's and staffed it the way I felt?
It is not, but I think the implications are different. Who the NFL is serving and how they recruit talent is a lot different than how Trader Joe's works. Trader Joe's is going to feel the implications of their oppressive behaviors in a lot different of a way than the NFL is going to feel it. And so because of that, I could probably navigate a Trader Joe's that isn't working. I don't even know if they franchise, but as an example, I could navigate that, right? Like because you are going to feel the burn, not to mention we can, in some very pointed ways, make it really uncomfortable, even for people who want to consider continuing to support that Trader Joe's. Very uncomfortable. And that discomfort of that one Trader Joe's could be big enough of a deal to make others not engage with Trader Joe's at all. None of those are the case in the NFL. It's not. It's because of the way they get talent, which is the way sports gets talent, right? So you have to get the top to shift. And if you don't get the top to shift, the only other behavior is for people to say, I'm not engaging, period. I don't want to engage with the NFL at all. I don't want to. And that's hard. We like our sports. Honestly, a lot of us use sports as a getaway. I want something I don't have to think about. I'm going to enjoy it. It's going to send me on a ride. I'm going to feel all the things. And then I can put it down and let it go. So this being mired in this kind of controversy is automatically off-putting to people, which is why it's also hard to address.
Well, I love the fact that you were willing to spend some time with us addressing it, engaging, and giving people the tools to continue to think about it as it pertains to their homes, their businesses, and their lives. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Donovan. This was great.
Thanks so much to Amber. She was able to make some very nuanced and difficult things to talk about seem matter-of-fact and simple. Sometimes so much so that I felt dumb asking the question because her answer, as soon as she said it, made so much sense. If you want to have her help you with DEI strategy or speak to a group or find out what she's up to, AmberCabral.com is her website, AmberCabral.com. And you can hear that great insight for yourself with her Guilty Privilege podcast and blog. And if the written word is more your speed, don't worry, Amber has you covered there with her book, Say More About That, and other ways to speak up, push back, and advocate for yourself and others. It's a great resource for any underrepresented professionals, allies, advocates, people seeking to make a positive change in the workplace or in the world. Make sure you get that. Barnes & Noble, Amazon, independent bookshops, essentially wherever you get books. And be on the lookout for her upcoming title, Allies and Advocates. Once again, we appreciate you listening to the Going Deep podcast. More good, heartfelt conversation for you in the near future. Make sure you don't miss any of it. Listen, favorite, share, subscribe.